Hi, this is Andrew Phillips. Thank you for downloading the Graymeer Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. If you have any questions or if you'd like to contact us, check out our website at graymeer.com. We'd also love for you to visit with us in a worship service. You're always welcome at the Graymeer Church of Christ.
I got most of the way through that last session and realized, where's the clock? And I don't know where there's a clock. So he says it's up in the podium. So there's advantages to being down here. Although apparently, I'll leave it to you to let me know when I'll be ending. All right, so stand up or yell or something. Thank you for your interest and your encouragement. Many of you have come up and commented very, I'm not sure, excitedly or whatever, but some of this stuff is rather sobering. By the way, again, we're opening a museum at Harding that is going to have a lot of different artifacts in it. And so if you're ever at Harding and Searcy, it's going to be free for you to, not free for you to come, it's free for you to get in. We don't pay for your trip to get over there, but if you're in the Harding and Searcy area, please feel free to come and visit with us. Grand opening of that is going to be on Easter weekend. And the centerpiece actually is a display that's going to deal with the ossuary and the crucifixion, and I have an artifact set up and so forth that focuses upon all of this kind of stuff that we were talking about in the last session. I preached full-time for 25 years before beginning becoming a teacher at Harding, and I didn't even begin to get into archaeology as a formal kind of pursuit until I was 33. So I was sort of late getting into it. A lot of people will tell me, I wanted to be an archaeologist when I was in fourth grade. And then they grew out of it. I sort of went at it the other way around. I wanted to be a preacher when I was like six, mom and dad tell me. And I still preach and so forth. But I got into archaeology late in life. But I do remember when I was making that transition, people would often say, wow, it's so great how archaeology proves the Bible. I want to pause on that one. I do want to pose the question, what does this have to do with that? And I think it's a legitimate kind of question. But I hesitate to use archaeology as an apologetic. And the reason for that is there are things that we discover in archaeology that we can't quite figure out how it fits with the Bible. And there are things that the Bible says sometimes that we can't quite figure out what's going on in archaeology. And how do these relate to one another? And that's where the challenge arises. Now, having said that, there are these fashions in thought that occur. Cycles that take place, things that are in vogue, that are out of vogue, that are back in vogue, sort of like tie widths and all that kind of stuff, you know. And so you'll have these fluctuations of ideas. And there was a long time when the Bible and archaeology had no connection whatsoever. Then there was a section in which it was almost touted that everything that's discovered in archaeology relates to the Bible. And then it became skeptical again, and now it's sort of bifurcated and going in different directions. And you have the cynics that say nothing in the Bible is true. And then others will make a connection with everything that is going on. So you have all kinds of confusion. But let me put it this way. My default setting, now that's sort of a computer-ese kind of thing. My default setting is the Bible is true. End of discussion. I mean, that's where it is for me. Now, if I find something that's going on in archaeology, sometimes it's a matter of theory and the ideas that are associated with it. Sometimes it's the artifacts. I don't know what's going on. But if I find in archaeology something that I can't quite figure out what it does with archaeology, I'm not going to say the Bible is wrong. Because there are so many times, I'm not going to say too many times because that makes it sound like, you know, it shouldn't be this way. But there are so many times that given enough time in investigation, what we find in archaeology does end up meshing. All right. So to say that these are at odds with one another intrinsically is a misstatement. Roland DeVoe, a great Catholic archaeologist back a number of years ago, argued, and he would not agree with how I'm going to necessarily say this, but I think his description is apropos. He argued that it should be the case that archaeology and biblical studies should mesh, and they should agree. And if they don't, either we're not understanding the biblical text correctly, or we're not understanding the archaeological material correctly, or we're not understanding either one of them correctly. And I think that sums it up fairly well. Because all of us have this fallibility about us where we do not have perfect understanding and perfect knowledge. And the archaeological world is so piecemeal that it's difficult to figure out exactly what all is going on. Now, as if we take this building, for instance, and imagine we just all were to get up and walk out and not take anything with us other than our personal belongings, and we just evacuated the building and left it to deteriorate on its own. Well, what would happen? After a period of time, you've got these massive wood beams that would eventually collapse, and the structure would cave in, and there would be the inevitable vermin people that would come in, and little boys love the sound of breaking glass, all right? So you'd have broken glass windows all over the place because that's so great fun to hear the shattering of glass, at least for little boys. I'm probably divulging way too much about myself. Then you would have the people that would come in and they would steal stuff that they would want to take. They might chop up the pews and burn them and so forth, or recycle them. I mean, all kinds of things that would happen. And over a period of time, there would be very little left, relatively speaking, of this structure. And then you were to come along and try to reconstruct this building on the basis of its remains 2,000 years from now, that would be difficult to do. Because there are so many gaps in the database. Well, that's the inevitable problem that we have with archaeology. And this is one reason why the discovery, for instance, of Tutankhamun's tomb is so fantastic, is because basically it was, I hesitate to use the word frozen in time because it was Egypt after all. You had this time capsule that is preserved here with foodstuffs and with resins and with hair and garments and fabrics and everything else that under normal circumstances would not have occurred. And that's one reason why that discovery was so fantastic, is because it preserved everything for all practical purposes. But there's still, I'm sure, some things that escaped preservation. But when we think in terms of archaeology, it's inevitably a piecemeal kind of thing. It's partial. It's always partial. And as time passes, it becomes more and more partial. And hence the difficulty sometimes of connecting what we find with what's going on in the biblical text. Now, I'm not going to say there's no apologetic value to archaeology in the Bible, because I think there is. But I would prefer to look at it from a standpoint of how illustrative and how it enriches our understanding of what's going on in the biblical narrative. And the more we understand the biblical narrative, the better equipped we are to have a confidence in its validity. Not that we are questioning that. Again, as believers, we don't question the validity of the Bible, but it becomes richer and deeper. Let's put it that way. It becomes more substantive in our lives as we realize these things really did happen. This is not going on in a vacuum. So what I want to look at this morning briefly with you, and this is one of those lessons I can stop anytime I want to, or anytime you tell me, you know, if everybody gets up and walks out, I'm done, all right. But this is one of those sort of categories. And so the first section I want us to consider is this issue of customs of the biblical world. Now, what I'm going to narrate here are skewed perspectives that I had as a youngster. My dad was a preacher. And I've literally been raised in a church family all my life. Mom and Dad tell me that I was in church the first Sunday after I was born. I remember it well. But, you know, that's how I was exposed to this. And I never went through this period of rebellion. I never went through, you know, I defy Christianity and all that kind of stuff. I was always someone who was a person of faith. Now, admittedly, you know, I'm not going to claim perfection by any means, but religion and faith were always important components in my life. But I didn't always understand what was going on because I would read the text from my own worldview. And this is almost inescapable. And I'm not getting into the postmodern kind of discussion, the philosophical issues, but there's a certain framework within which all of us tend to read the Bible and read any kind of literature from our own worldview. But archaeology can help us modify and correct some of those misconceptions that sometimes we have. And so we go next. We're looking at some customs. Now, in the Bible, it will talk about do not remove the ancient landmarks. Now, when I was a youngster, I was born in East Tennessee, and we lived in East Tennessee until we moved to California when I was 10. And I remember driving down the road and seeing historical landmark ahead, or historical marker ahead. And I always thought in terms of ancient landmarks as historical markers. So when I talk about don't remove the ancient landmarks, I always thought in terms of don't break down those historical markers that are along the highway. And I always wanted to stop and read these. I guess it was sort of a precursor to me getting into archaeology. We rarely ever would stop and look at them, but nonetheless, I was always fascinated with this. Well, for me to impose a historical marker on an ancient landmark reference in the Bible is an inappropriate interpretive strategy. But the ancient landmarks were customs and traditions of the ancient world that were extremely important. To give you some perspective, in Deuteronomy chapter 27, God talks to the children of Israel through Moses, and he says, when you get in the land of Canaan, then you go to Mount Ebal and Gerizim, you shall pronounce these curses. And among the curses are, cursed be he who removes the ancient landmark. Wow. I mean, that's pretty heavy stuff. This is like within the setting, cursed be he who lies with his mother. Okay. Pretty heavy kind of stuff that he's condemning here. And so it should make us sit up and take notice. So God is serious about this ancient landmark kind of stuff. Well, this is an example of the ancient landmarks. And what they are were boundary markers. And in this case, you have this line of stones in the middle of this field, and it's separating this person's field from that person's. Now, this is exactly what is going on in the narrative in the book of Ruth, where Ruth and Naomi are returning or coming to Bethlehem. And Ruth is going to have to try to gather the food for the family. And the Bible in chapter 2 says she goes to that part of the field that belonged to Boaz. Now, rather than like our world in which farmers typically live out on the farm and then will go into town, okay, in this part of the world they would typically live in town and go out into the field to work in the day and then return in the evening. And that's what's being described here. And so she happens to go to that part of the field that belonged to Boaz as opposed to Jaime Thudpucker next door. Jaime's my imaginary friend. All right. And so she goes to this part rather than Jaime's, and so things unfold positively here as she is gathering up the grain. Well, here's another example. Next is another example of these ancient landmarks. Now, this series is more of a dotted line that goes across the field. Now, if somebody were really dishonest, it would be easy for someone under cover of absolute darkness to go out there and move those over about 6 or 7 inches, and you do that over the course of several years, you have increased your land holding and shrunk your neighbors. It's land rustling. Not cattle rustling, but land rustling. And God's saying, don't do that. If you actually go look at all of the passages where these ancient landmarks occur in the pages of the Old Testament, to a large extent, God's concern is trying to preserve the sustenance for the widows and orphans and the inheritance that they deserve. It's a social system that God is concerned with. Now, you and I, in our modern world, when we're buying or selling property, one of the things we want to have done and that is insisted upon with the escrow companies is that there be a survey of our property to make sure that we get all that we're paying for, etc., etc., etc. That's what this is all about. It has nothing to do with a particular event that occurred here. But this is an example of my skewed understanding. Now, eventually, obviously, there's been a refinement. Next. Now, this is an example of the fields under cultivation where you can see faintly the line running down the middle of this, but the crop is the same on both sides. Well, apparently, at some point, this is one person's property and that's another person's, and they just happen to be cultivating the same thing. Next. Another passage that I did not understand as a youngster was the watchtowers. In the book of Isaiah and the book of Matthew, there are two parables that deal with buying property and building a watchtower in it. And I used to always think in terms of we're traveling through East Tennessee in the old days of the 60s and so forth, as a, well, actually in this case the 50s when I was not a teenager. And we'd see these signs of, you know, fire tower and watchtower up ahead. And I always wanted to go and, you know, climb up those and look at this, and never did. Mom and Dad wouldn't let me. And but when I would read this business of watchtower, I would think in terms of a fire watchtower. Well, that's not what these are for. The purpose of these watchtowers, of which this is an excellent example in one of the fields, terraced fields in the central hills of Judea and Samaria, these have to do with posting someone there in time of harvest to protect against theft. Now, my son-in-law raises alfalfa out in Southern California. And it was always interesting when we go visit to watch him and listen to him as the harvest cycles occur. And he became concerned about people coming to steal the alfalfa bales. And so he would post guards out there to protect against crop theft. Well, same kind of problem. I mean, things have not changed. And so there are always these people in society, somewhere in society, who tend to be dishonest. And this is what the watchtower was there to do, to protect against theft from the time of harvest of the crops. Next. Now, another task that would be involved, one that has escaped most of our younger generation, has to do with baking bread. Most of us enjoy homemade bread and so forth, but it's to a large extent a lost art. And I'm not sure a lot of young people today realize that you can bake the stuff. I think they think it only comes in plastic bags in the store. But the process, and I've never lived in an environment where you had to go through all of this. Sharon would occasionally go through these cycles where she'd buy the raw grain and grind it and all this kind of stuff and bake the bread. Oh, good thing she doesn't do that all the time. But anyway. But this is a threshing sledge that's standing up here in the background. Very labor intensive, extremely intensive kind of activity. These are three boards that are lined up. They're standing on end. This is not their normal position. But in the bottom of these, there are these holes that have been drilled, and they would drive flint stones into this. Next slide will show that in use, dragging it around on the grain and the barley that is spread out on the threshing floor. And you'll drag this around, and those flint pieces of stone will break the grain away from the stalks. Now, what are you going to do then? Because now you've got this mess that most people freak out. You know, I don't know if you've ever been one of those eating your bowl of cereal and here's a piece of grass floating in it. You know, people freak out over that. Get a life. Okay. Anyway, now if it's rat hair, that's another issue. But, if there's a piece of stalk floating around, you know, get a life. But, you know, most people don't want that in their bread and in their grain products. So they have to then winnow it, and the next picture will show the winnowing process, where you take a shovel or a fork and jam it into the collection and throw it up in the air, and the wind blows the chaff away, and the grain falls back to the ground. And you do this over and over and over and over and over and over again until you get to a point where you don't see any dust blowing away. And then you gather the grain up into the storage vessels. This is what John is talking about when he talks about the Lord coming and gathering the grain into his harvest, and the chaff will be burned with unquenchable fire. This is the setting and the threshing and the winnowing process that is involved in that dynamic. Next photograph shows I'm in the process here of leaving a site of Gibeon, and there was this threshing floor with the grain that is heaped up on the threshing floor. It's a setting like this, again back into the book of Ruth, where in chapter 3, Ruth goes to the threshing floor where Boaz is spending the night having winnowed the grain, didn't have enough time to gather it up into the vessels or the baskets or jars or whatever and take it home. And so he's still there protecting his crop against theft. He's going to sleep at the threshing floor, and Ruth is going to go there and initiate the negotiation for marriage. I picture Boaz in a scene like this, throwing down his cloak on the grain, laying down and nestling down into a select mattress kind of thing to get just right, and then dozing off to sleep, and here comes Ruth. But it would be a scene similar to this where those events would have unfolded. Next. As I was leaving the site of Gibeon, I looked down the way and happened to notice on top of this house, this stuff drying on the roof. And I immediately thought of Rahab hiding the spies underneath the flax drying on the roof at Jericho. Now, again, when I would read these kind of episodes with roofs kind of stuff, I used to always wonder, you know, what's going on here? Because Mom and Dad, typical roof that I'm accustomed to is a pitch roof as a youngster. And so I was not accustomed to a flat roof like this. I didn't think in terms of flat roofs. But this part of the world, it doesn't rain much. And the roof actually was used as sort of a patio. Well, Mom and Dad never allowed me to use our roof as a patio. Matter of fact, I was forbidden to be on the roof. And if they ever caught me on the roof, I was in big trouble. All right. But the roofs were not places. I mean, they're rather dangerous, being pitched roofs and so forth, but there are also other problems that can erupt. But I did not understand all of this until I broadened my horizons and my understandings. Now, another element that comes into play, because of the prevalence of roofs being used as sort of patios, you remember the episode in the story of Elisha, whenever the woman recognizes that Elisha is a prophet and she convinces her husband, let's build that room on top of the roof as a little place for him to stay with a bed and a table and a chair and so forth. Well, she's going to turn the roof into an apartment. Then you have Peter in the book of Acts goes up on the roof to pray. Now, on a certain level, that doesn't say anything because, you know, you can do that on any kind of a roof situation. But in this situation, the roof is certainly away from the hubbub of the activity. When Saul is looking for his donkeys and Samuel then, they go to Samuel. Samuel then welcomes into his house and Saul sleeps up on the roof. And the next morning he's going to be anointed as king. Roofs pop up quite a number of times within the pages of Scripture. And there's even in the book of Deuteronomy a legislation where God says, when you build a house, you shall do exactly what is here. Have a low wall around the perimeter of the house so that someone will not fall off. Well, that's building code. Now, I don't know if there were building inspectors in the ancient world, but that's basically building code. And it has to do with a liability issue. And God was concerned about the liability issues. Rahab is using the roof as another room. And so, the more we understand about these, the better our appreciation is of the way the people live. Next. Here is a picture of Gibeon, and it's a city set on a hill. And of course, you have to realize that cities in the land of Palestine almost always are built on hills. Jesus' remark there in Matthew chapter 5 is sort of a given. That's the way almost all the towns are built in the land of Palestine. Because there's not a whole lot of valley areas to cultivate. They would not build their cities down in the valley because that would eat away their valuable fertile soil. So they build up on the hill, but they also are able to defend themselves better on a hillside. And so here we have a classic example. The next picture is looking at the city of Gibeon from down below. And notice the nicely cultivated fields down on the foot of the hill. Now the problem that occurs with having a city built on a hill is most of the time the water source is a spring outside of the city. Next. Which brings us to the discussion of technology in the ancient world. Yeah, I'll make sure we're dealing with the right thing. Technology. We often don't think in terms of the technology of the ancient world, but when we are more fair-minded, we realize, boy, they had a lot of technology. Sometimes to the point that we don't even understand how they did what they did. Now, sometimes to the point where people, and I don't know if I'm going to step on anybody's toes here, but sometimes we are so arrogant of thinking we are so far ahead of everybody else, if we do not know how they did it, then they didn't do it. Like pyramids. You know, we've not figured out exactly how they built the pyramids, and therefore the assumption is on the part of some people, space aliens built them. What? That's a strange jump to make. But the technology of the ancient world was really quite sophisticated. And they're dealing with problems that they are trying to address and trying to solve. And one of those has to do with, next picture, the water supply. If a city is set on a hill and the water source is outside the city, one of the vulnerabilities is that water supply being sabotaged by the enemy. or being cut off from that by an enemy. Now, we're back at the site of Gibeon, and here we have a map up here on the upper left-hand corner. This is the inside of the city, and this is the outside of the city, okay? And there's a tunnel that begins inside the city wall and goes down here to the water source. Now, this is a flight of steps. This is the entrance into the tunnel there. This is the flight of steps, and you finally reach the water supply down below. I guess I was doing that, wasn't I? Was I doing that? You timed that very well. I was impressed. All right, so this is the water system and the access to it. Now, in times of siege, they could close the entrance over here so that you could get to the water supply without any problem. Securely, take your water jar, water skin, go down there, fill it up, go outside, back into the security of the town, within the walls, everything's fine. Now, this dates to about the 9th century B.C. Now, there was an earlier water system that was not as efficient. Next slide. We start off the same way. Here's our map. There's the water supply, but there's also a water table, and here's the big shaft that they've dug straight down. Now, you get some idea of perspective here by looking at the people drawn on the platform there. You can see the flight of steps that go around the perimeter of this. The diameter of this is about 25 feet. The height is about 80 feet. And so you take the flight of steps going down the way. And there's the flight of steps in reality. Reaching the water table, filling up your water jar, and going back up the other direction. Next slide. Here's a picture of me standing on that platform. Now this scene appears and is referred to in the book of Samuel. After Saul has died, and Abner and Joab gather at the pool of Gibeon. Now, it's important to realize, when it talks about the pool of Gibeon, you're talking about a specific... This is important.
No, that's good. Keep going. I'm just saying.
How much time I got?
Three more minutes.
Three more minutes. All right. Just tell me when to quit. All right. Wow. What was I talking about? They're at the pool of Gibeon, and 12 soldiers from Saul's side, 12 soldiers from David's side, are going to be thrown into a battle in close combat. Now, the pool of Gibeon is a specific location, and this is where that occurred. And I'm of the opinion, and all I can say is I'm of the opinion, that it's on that platform that they're thrown into that close quarter combat and battling it out. And, of course, the Bible describes that all 24 of the soldiers die. Of course, it doesn't resolve anything. Warfare rarely does. I'm not going to say it never does, but it rarely does solve all of the problems that otherwise are occurring. Next. Again, technology. Imagine trying to make these. And I know artisans who do this. Make these kind of things, carving these artifacts out of ivory without electronic tools. I know there are some individuals that will work with chisels and so forth. Dr. England in Harding is extremely adept at this kind of thing, hand carving birds and painting them and all of this kind of stuff. But this is the product of a lot of intensive labor. Now, one of the things that's really interesting as you look at this, you can see the artifact here that has a tab at the top and a tab at the bottom. Now, sometimes these are found with letters on them. That would be, for instance, if we were doing it in English, the top tab would have the letter A and the bottom tab would have the letter B. Well, that reminds me of going to the local Walmart and buying a box of furniture. And all you need is a crescent wrench and a screwdriver. Take it home and follow the directions. Put it together. Put tab A into slot A and put tab B into slot B. And then, you know, put it together, assuming you can read the instructions in the first place. Well, not much has changed here. Things are fairly normal in how these kind of things unfold. But this is some of the technology. Next picture, I've got to talk about this one. These artifacts look like bronze, but they're not. They're copper. And they date from the time of about 3500 BC. And they had learned at that point how to extract the copper, temper it with arsenic, to make it more malleable and workable, and then also learn how to weld the pieces together. And I said, welding. I mean, this is remarkable technology in the ancient world. For 3500 B.C., this is way ahead of what we normally think in terms of. Now, originally when these were discovered, they were thought to have been associated with the temple destruction in 70 A.D. But the context and everything else was way out of kilter. We were 3,000 years off in the estimation of the value of these things. Next. Sewer pipes from the time of the patriarchs. And most people don't think in terms of the ancient world having sewer pipes. Now, not all towns did. But certainly there were some that did, some more sophisticated than others. And if you look at these sewer pipes, they're basically no different than sewer pipes that now exist. I mean, the technology has not changed here. They're sealed the same way, and the water flow, sewage flow would be basically the same kind of approach. Next. This is the entrance into the water system at Beth Shemesh, which is not a spring, it's a cistern. Next picture will show a cutaway of the cruciform reservoir. But what I really want to show you is in the next slide, has to do with the plaster that is still on the walls, on most of the parts of the walls. This cistern was sealed up and covered over in 635 B.C. and never discovered again until 1990 A.D. And it still has plaster on the walls in that sealed context for 2,700 years. We seem not to be able to get plaster to stick on a wall for 50 years. You know, how is it that they were able to do this? I mean, this is impressive technology kind of stuff. Next picture will show another evidence of technological understanding, and it's this surgical procedure known as a trephination. The person had a headache, I guess. And they're going to try to solve the problem with a headache. And so they remove the flap of skin and they saw a chunk of skull out of the person's head. This individual didn't last long. And the reason we know that is because of the crispness of the saw marks that are on the back of the head. It's about right there in relationship to the skull. Although we know from other skulls that have been discovered that have had the same kind of procedure that a lot of people survived years afterward because the wound is fully healed. Now that raises an interesting question. What drug are they on? I mean, I really hope they're under something. And can I have about 2 minutes? Give me two. No bells have rung. Are you the bell? Next picture. Okay, next. I have here a vessel known as a bilbil. And this dates from 1300 B.C. And these vessels are associated with the island of Cyprus. And the archaeologists, when we've known of these for years, and you'll notice the little white lines that are on here and the little raised appliques and so forth. And the question was, what were these used for? And the next photograph will show some proposal here. If you turn it upside down and look at it like that, it looks sort of like an opium poppy. And a lot of folks, whenever the proposal was made, says, yes, you've been smoking it too. But we now have been able to run residue tests on some of these, and there is evidence of opiate derivatives on the interior of these. May I propose the possibility that this opiate derivative was not necessarily just for recreational use, although I'm sure that that was the case in some circumstances, but that it was used in some of those medical procedures. But this also exposes us to the idea and the reality of trade over long distances. People in the ancient world learned where resources were and how to access them and would trade goods and services for each other, just like in our world today. Now, I am going to tie this up because he's pressuring me up here, even though he is not, it's just his presence that's bugging me. When I was in local ministry, and sadly I even hear this with some relative frequency at the university, when people would argue the Bible is irrelevant because it is so old and out of date and it does not connect with us in our world. I did not expect this result to occur when I got into archaeology as an academic enterprise. But one of the things that I discovered was there's a very real sense in which we are really no different than the people in the ancient world. We've changed the technical ways we do things. But the issues that the Bible is addressing are the same kind of issues that are still major issues in the hearts and lives of people today. What is the meaning of life? How do we get along with one another? How do we interact with our government? How do we interact with our enemies? What is the purpose of, you know, is there an afterlife? How do we deal with our children? Where do we get our next meal? Who is the one that provides us with the blessings that we have? All of these questions are still the same kind of questions. We have a tendency sometimes to divert our attention from those things that are really important to get bogged down in a lot of technical issues that are basically technological differentiations and not fundamental issues. And one of the things I wanted to do in this discussion was to demonstrate that times have changed from a technological standpoint, but even then, many times, not as much as we like to think. There have always been these kinds of concerns, and humanity has risen to the task to adapt to its environment very appropriately, given the circumstances that they're dealing with. God's Word is still viable in our world today, no matter how sophisticated we like to think we are. I don't think we're any more sophisticated than the people of the ancient world. If you'll bow with me as we close with a word of prayer. Dear Lord, our Father, we are so grateful for the blessing of life and the blessings that you give us each day. We thank you for the minds that you've given us, and help us to use our minds and our bodies in service to you. And help us to try to help others to see the blessings that you bestow upon us and offer to us, and for us all to submit to your will in humble obedience. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen. There you are. Let you do whatever you're going to do.
We'll make our way to the fellowship hall now, and there'll be several lines, so be sure to spread out as we go through. Thank you.
That was shorter than I anticipated.